Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. The annual celebration of Connecticut Agriculture Day was held recently at the state capitol in Hartford, and For the People was invited back to humbly receive an award from the Connecticut Agricultural Information Council. So we took the opportunity to grab a chat with a number of participants, including the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association, the Farmer Veteran Coalition, the Connecticut Farm Bureau, the UConn Extension, the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut, Very Alive, the Dean of UConn's College of Agriculture, Health, and Natural Resources, and even the state's Department of Agriculture's commissioner himself. So stay tuned and hear some inspiring stories and important information straight from the folks who tend our farms and deliver Connecticut's farm fresh fare to our markets and tables. We'll jump right out onto the floor at Connecticut Ag Day 2025 right after this. On April 5th and 6th, Evan Titus is taking a tremendous journey to support the kids at the Southport, Smilo, Burroughs, and Madison Avenue clubhouses. Evan is setting out to run across the entire state of Connecticut to raise awareness and funds for the Wakeman's Boys and Girls Club Network. He's a 25-year-old accomplished runner from Norwalk with a goal of running for 150 consecutive miles diagonally across the state over an estimated 24 to 26-hour period, and he wants to raise $15,000 for the Wakeman's Boys and Girls Club through donations and sponsorships. If you'd like to learn more about this incredible effort and the organizations and young people he hopes to support and ways you can support him, just visit the Wakeman Boys and Girls Club website at wakemanclub.org. All right, the calm before the storm here at the state capitol and Connecticut Ag Day 2025. And as we try to do every time we visit here, catch up with our commissioner of the Connecticut State Department of Agriculture. And Brian Herbert has been kind enough to give us a few minutes. So, Commissioner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for being here and celebrating Ag Day with us.
So let's talk cheese. Connecticut cheese is on the global map now.
Right. So we are very proud that Arethusa Cheese Company in northwest corner of Connecticut won back-to-back national awards for best cheese in America. My friends in Wisconsin and Vermont are not very happy, but we're really proud, and they do a great job. And not only do they do a great job making the cheese, but they buy their milk to make the cheese from three small Connecticut farms who otherwise might not have a market. So it's a really important business for the ag economy that's doing amazing things.
And it speaks to the boutique nature of what agriculture is becoming and has been for at least a good decade and a half here in Connecticut.
Right. Well, and it used to be buy local, but now it's like buy hyper local, right? We want to know exactly where the food is coming from, who the farmers are. And we can do that in Connecticut because we are such a close-knit community.
The other thing that puts Connecticut on the map is our oysters. And we always like to talk about aquaculture because they don't get the equal love, it seems, sometimes. So let's take a few minutes on that.
Yeah, my good friend Commissioner Katie Dykes thinks of Long Island Sound as recreational swimming and fishing. And I think of it as a big farm, right? We've got 60,000 plus acres of shellfish beds in
Long
Island.
The biggest agricultural pursuit in Connecticut is underwater.
That's right, the largest farm in New England is underwater in Long Island Sound and is a Connecticut farmer. So that's a piece of our past and our future that's really a tremendous opportunity that people tend to forget, but we don't. And that's why we've been working with our partners at DECD to do the Oyster Trail, to do the Oyster Documentary, to drive people to remember and recognize that resource and those businesses that we have and the tremendous product they put out.
Every time your department sends me their regular e-newsletter, it's packed with maybe not one, not two, or maybe three possible grant or funding opportunities designed to attract, install, and sustain Connecticut farmers. How's it going bringing this young generation of farmers online that are going to be populating the halls here at Ag Day today?
Yeah, so We have spent over the past few years a lot of attention with our New and Beginning Farmers. We created a New and Beginning Farmer micro grant program, $5,000 award. We just awarded 12 of those in the last round. We also are looking at second career opportunities. And we know, and you were just acknowledged today for your work with Connecticut Farmer Veterans Coalition, we know that the men and women coming out of the service have a tremendous skill set. And they don't necessarily need to work for somebody else. A lot of them can do very well working for themselves. And at our most recent Ag Transition Grant Award, we were able to award 8 farmer veterans awards to support their business and give them the opportunity. I say it a lot, but we want to look back on our Connecticut agricultural heritage and think about ways that we can sustain that for as far as we can into the future. And the investments that we're making propel those farm businesses to do the next thing, to meet the customer where they are, and to be ready for it.
We're blessed that these veterans still continue to want to serve their Absolutely. Neighbors and their state with a work ethic that is maybe unmatched.
Oh, nobody works harder. I mean, nobody works harder than a farmer. Nobody works harder than a farmer veteran because they know how to get the job done. And the service teaches them to do what they can with the resources they have available. So they are problem solvers. They're figuring out how to get something done with what they have on hand, which is a great skill set to apply in farming.
Well, we've hit 3 very positive points. I hate to steer us toward how you and your department is dealing with the avian flu situation here in Connecticut, but is there a silver lining or at least a light at the end of the tunnel as far as you can see today?
Well, we're working closely with our partner agencies of the Department of Public Health and the Department of Consumer Protection on avian influenza, both in dairy and in poultry. We're very concerned about this. And I think the silver lining is that people acknowledge that we have farms in our community, that they are farm businesses, that animal health and human health are closely related, and so we've got to make sure that we're protecting our farms to protect our neighbors. And Connecticut farmers are stepping up. We're distributing PPE across the state through the Department of Public Health to make sure that farmers have masks and gloves and booties so that they're reducing the risk. We're working with our partners at UConn Extension to put on webinars and forums so that people know how they can protect their farm. Because protecting their farm is not only about protecting their farm, it's about protecting their neighbors and the farms around them. And that's the message we're trying to drive home on that.
Very good. Thank you so much. CT.gov/DOAG is the website that anybody needs to go to learn more about the many things the Connecticut Department of Agriculture is doing here today and into the future. I'm pleased to have Commissioner Brian Hurlburt back on as we open up our special report from Ag Day at the Capitol 2025. Commissioner, thank you again. All right, we are back here at Connecticut Ag Day at the state capitol. We try to come out here every year and talk to some of the folks that are showing off their Connecticut grown and Connecticut pride all at the same time. And I am pleased to introduce Chris Valley. He is with Pride's Corner Farms, based in Lebanon, but with farms across the state. And he happens to be president of the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association this year. Year, right? It's an annual thing?
That is correct, yes. Every year.
Well, let's start with Pride's Corner Farms. What's that all about?
Pride's Corner Farms is a wholesale grower. We're the largest wholesale grower in the state. We have 4 locations. Our primary location is in Lebanon, Connecticut. We have 3 others in Suffield, Cromwell, and Ledyard, where we specialize in growing different crops at each. We grow trees, shrubs, roses, anything you can plant in your yard. We grow and supply to the local garden center and landscape trade.
Vegetable and fruit crops as well?
Yes, those as well, and herbs and ground covers. We do a lot of fruit trees, fruit bushes. So, again, anything you plant in your yard, we grow.
That's amazingly diverse. For folks that are probably looking at the weather and the fact that spring is just around the corner, what are a couple of the most important things you guys at the farm are doing right now?
Right now, we're navigating the weather. We're trying to uncover some hoop houses so the plants can acclimate, but not going too crazy in case we get really cold here in the next week or two. We are shipping a lot of trucks out every day, so we're pulling product, loading product, and shipping product.
How long have you been involved with the association?
For probably about 7 years. This is my third year as president of the association, and it's my 25th year working at Pride's Corner Farms.
So explain to folks a little bit about how the association serves Connecticut agricultural professionals and the industry.
Of course. We represent all the garden centers, wholesale growers, and landscapers in this state. We are their voice. We are monitoring the bills that are going on here at the Capitol building and the area around here for them. And we put on a couple different events each year to get the membership together. We are just, we're monitoring the entire industry for them.
Yeah. And what are some of the legislative actions that you guys are trying to support? Or opposed?
Well, currently, right now, what's floating around is a ban on neonicotinoids, which is a chemical used in the growing process of plants. There's also a bill to ban rodenticides, which is used on our farms to get rid of pests. And there's a bill floating around to ban gas backpack leaf blowers, which is used by most of our landscape trade.
I bet the third one's going to be the hard one.
It is. Yes, it's going to be the hard one. So we're working with many groups to try to come up with a compromise so that everybody is kind of happy.
So what is the alternative? Electric or manual?
It's electric, yeah. The push towards battery-powered power tools in the landscape trade is pretty hot and heavy right now. A lot of it has to do with the sound that's made.
Yeah. How is technology and mechanics keeping up with efforts like yours globally, or at least around the country?
Well, in the association, not too much. The big technology is switching from gas to electric on most of the tools. In the plant growing arena, it's a constant new tech being introduced. Basically, the machinery is getting smarter, so we can replace a person with a machine in some aspects of our industry.
Is the use of electric mowers and whackers and blowers, has the technology of that kind of equipment gotten to the point where it's an easier sell to landscape companies and individual homeowners to make that switch?
Not really. No, it hasn't quite gotten there yet. I think we're getting close, though. Right now, the amount of energy it takes to power the batteries that are being used by the crews is becoming more and more expensive each year. So it's making it more expensive to operate.
Well, let's switch gears to the stuff that you've been involved with most of your life and are selling and representing with the association. As climate changes here in Connecticut and the seasons get weirder and summers get hotter and winters are wetter, what type of shift are you seeing in product lines, particularly for homeowners that are going to be flocking to garden centers all over the place to pick out the decorative plant shrubs and trees that they're going to be planting around their own homes or businesses in the next year? Has the association or your members had to start looking at maybe phasing out certain types of popular products in order to adapt more climate-friendly ones?
Mm-hmm. Well, simply put, yes. As the earth warms, some plants that weren't hardy to live here in Connecticut are becoming hardy to live here in Connecticut. So, yes, there's new product, new types of plants that now we can plant here that we couldn't 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. They just wouldn't have lived. As far as trends go with people and plants this spring, very much people are looking for plants that have multi-purpose, not just a one-time flower a year and that's it. They're looking for things that fruit, that flower, that give you multi-seasons of interest. That's definitely been a trend. And smaller plants. People want smaller plants. Lots are getting smaller. People don't have sprawling lawns anymore. They have smaller lots. So more dwarf plants are being introduced.
Yeah, I guess the move toward meadowing one's property or parts of it is starting to get pretty popular and has a great environmental benefit.
It does. One of the products we grow is called American Beauty Native Plants, and it's a branded line of truly native plants to Connecticut and the surrounding area. And that has skyrocketed over the last 5-6 years. It's definitely a popular item now.
And wrap things up, I always like to talk to you folks like you about invasives. Is climate change promoting faster growth or greater proliferation of invasives that are victimizing the product, very products that you're selling to consumers?
Mm-hmm. No, not really, to answer your question, which is refreshing, right?
Yeah.
No, there is a bunch of, we just recently, the CNLA partnered with the Invasive Plant Council, and we put forth a recommendation to ban about 10 plants that are currently out there in the world. So we are into that, and we work with others, and we don't want invasive plants out in the world. But the line from an invasive plant to just an aggressive plant is kind of gray, so we do need to work together as plant people to make sure we're not doing the wrong thing.
And probably an entire segment's worth of conversation that we could have and go on and on about it. But for today, we'll cut you loose. A quarter century with Pride's Corner Farms,
yes.
And several years now leading the Connecticut Nursery and Landscape Association. Here from Ag Day at the Connecticut Capitol, Chris Valley. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Great. Good to see you.
Take care. We are continuing our traversing of the Capitol floor area here and ran into Tracy McDougall with the Connecticut Farm Bureau. Tracy, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about what people need to know about the Bureau and what you guys do.
We are here to help advocate for agriculture at the Capitol, and also for individual farms who need assistance with challenges they may be having on their farm.
So it's a membership organization?
Yeah, we're membership-based, targeting people who are actively farming and farms of all sizes, from smaller 5-6 acres to hundreds or thousands of acres.
And when you look across the landscape of agricultural industries in Connecticut, would you say you have a pretty healthy representation of both the diversity of products as well as, the quantity of farms and agricultural businesses that you'd like to see?
Yeah, our membership is very diverse, and your listeners might not know that one of the largest commodities in the state are greenhouse growers. Almost 50% of the commodities that are sales come through greenhouses in the state. That's a big industry for us. The next largest industry is dairy, which is not surprising. Those are tend to be pretty large operations. And then apples. And then from then on, the commodity groups are smaller, more sort of incremental.
At the same time, there seems to have been a movement over the past decade or so of either boutique farms or farms that have actually launched not only to provide food or vegetables or some sort of grown product, but also to serve as a venue to both entertain and teach people about agriculture. I'm talking about agritourism. Do you concur that is starting to become a viable revenue generator for Connecticut farms?
Yeah, agritourism is a critical source of revenue for, I would say, a majority of our farms. And as the climate change is impacting the success of a variety of different products, you throw in that agritourism source of revenue, and it provides a little stability. You can count on that agritourism money coming in. So, you see it in corn mazes and blueberry picking, and, people do weddings and all kinds of things. So it's a really critical source of revenue for our members.
The Farm Bureau also has its finger on the pulse here at the State House in regards to legislation. And I just saw an email go across my desk a couple days ago about legislation that's being considered that might potentially help protect farms that are engaged in agritourism in regards to liability.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bill asking for recognition legally of the inherent risks involved in agritourism. So sometimes people will slip and fall in a corn maze and then sue the farm. And it's, as your listeners know, that's a big hassle for the farmer and a big expense. And so just asking people, the law, to recognize that there are inherent risks when you're participating in agritourism activity. So we're hoping that that gets passed. We're also, there's a big push for a farm tax investment credit that we had a hearing on last week, and that would have a huge impact on our farms.
Talk more about that.
So that legislation, if you're a farmer and you buy, let's say, a tractor and it costs $160,000, you get a credit for that on your income tax. So it's a huge benefit for agriculture. And it only works if it's a capital investment, right? It's not like, oh, I bought 50 balloons for the birthday party.
Would it involve a 100% credit against the expenditure? Or is it somehow phased or scoped?
Yeah, the details of it, I'd have to look into a little bit more. But
it is a measurable relief.
It's 20%. So I think you take 20% of the value of that investment.
I see.
And then that's credited against whatever state income tax you pay. So it's a huge... And we're excited because it encourages farmers to invest in capital in their farm. So a building, a tractor, an expensive piece of equipment. So we're excited about that proposal.
Does the Connecticut Farm Bureau also partner with other similar membership organizations to kind of, you know, put strength behind movement?
Yeah, you know, we work with Very Alive, which is a dairy organization in the eastern part of the state. We work with CT NOFA, and there's, you know, more power. The more people, the more power. So we're always looking to collaborate.
Is it? Would you mind if I just asked you, as we stand here today, because things change fast in Washington, are there any particular things that you are looking for citizen advocacy in regards to things that are happening right now in Washington that have a significant impact or could or will have a significant impact on Connecticut farmers and your members?
So there was one source of funding that our farmers really benefited from, which was money that was allocated to Connecticut Food Share to purchase food for the hungry from local Connecticut farmers, and that funding has ended, and it's a big problem. It's unfortunate for our farmers and even more unfortunate for people who are hungry. So, you know, any phone calls to your federal legislators to advocate for that would be a big help.
Yeah, I have to believe our Connecticut delegation is lined up fully in support of retaining that funding. But also, you know, there's a lot of big farms in red states, too.
Yeah, agriculture cuts across all income levels and all political persuasions. And we have great relationships with Republicans and Democrats and unfortunately, all states are being affected by these ag cuts. And we have members who have implemented energy-saving projects on their farms that were funded by the federal government. And the way that this particular program works is you put in the solar panels, you've signed a contract that you'll be reimbursed for them, and now the federal government is saying there's no money there. After you've signed a contract and installed the solar panels on your farm, and you've spent $50,000 or $100,000 with a contract saying that the money will be paid, which is very similar. Like, I just had a plug-in installed in my house for my electric car, and it was the same way. I picked out an approved piece of equipment. I had it properly installed. I sent them the receipts. I had to send them a picture of the...
Your fulfillment was complete.
And then they said, great, here's your, you know, I got a stipend or whatever.
Yeah.
And so now it's the same process with our farmers, and they're being told, tough luck. So it's rough out there.
Well, hopefully folks can, you know, put their energy toward at least expressing concern and advocacy to reinstate these support programs. But before we let you go, Tracy, just let people know that the Connecticut Farm Bureaus and the regional farm bureaus are not exclusive membership to farmers. Anybody can be a Farm Bureau supporter.
Yeah. We need support from everyone, and we're happy to have non-farmers or even people who have a little backyard garden, and I think they would find our the information and programs that we provide would be of interest to a general audience as well.
How do they get to know you, your organization?
So we have a website, C as in cat, F as in Frank, B as in boy, A as in apple, .org. We're located in Wethersfield, Connecticut, and our phone number is 860-768-1100.
CFBA.org?
Yeah.
Tracy McDougall, president of the Connecticut Farm Bureau, here today at Ag Day at the Capitol. Thank you, Tracy. We don't like to yet let a year go by here at Ag Day at the Capitol without touching base with the School of Nutrition Association of Connecticut, or SNAC. Kate Murphy is with us this year. Kate, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Thank you for having me.
So give folks the quick spiel about SNAC.
So SNACT is the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut. We are the professional organization that represents anyone that works in school cafeterias in the state of Connecticut. We focus a lot on connecting classrooms to the cafeteria and educating students on where their food comes from as well.
So you guys are responsible for making sure that kids know food doesn't grow on big box shelves.
Correct. A funny story is I talked with a student a couple years ago, and I asked them if they knew where pickles came from, and they said the grocery store. So I knew that was my opportunity to teach children how to actually make their own pickles out of cucumbers.
And I have to believe, thanks to your movement and those partnering with you, that we now have at least a couple of generations of young Connecticut residents, for the most part, who are much more aware of where food comes from.
Yes, and it's so important right now that we have funding to help connect our farmers to our cafeterias. We are starting the movement that we are purchasing directly from the farmers and using those products in our school cafeterias to feed our young students.
We could spend an entire segment just talking about the issues on the education side of what's coming out of Washington, but for your purposes, there is a need for public outcry against the severing of funding that will be, it would have been in place or would be in place to help connect Connecticut farmers and the products they grow to the most important customers, Connecticut's young people, through the school networks.
Absolutely. It's an important piece to get the actual local products to our students so they understand we're helping our local people. We're helping our farmer that lives next door to us. We're also, the Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids Grant is also another key piece to funding that our state needs. And it's helping students grow their own food in their classrooms and teaching them that it doesn't come from the grocery store, that they can grow it themselves.
This is also an important movement addressing food insecurity, as you are, so to speak, teaching the person to create their own food because they may not have the money to go to the store and buy it. These days, that's a growing critical concern.
Yes, absolutely. If we could just teach one child how to grow their own lettuce or how to grow squash and then teach them what they can do with that, how to nourish their bodies with the things that they're actually growing themselves.
Tell us about some of the programs that you're involved with that will be sustained through this year and into the future?
Well, right now we have funding to purchase local right now, but that is ending at the end of this school year. A lot of schools are losing that funding at the end of the school year to help purchase local products.
And when we're talking about Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids, do you have some idea of the scope of farm involvement with the program? In other words, how much of Connecticut's farming output up to now is pipelining into our Connecticut school system?
That I actually don't have the statistics on, but we are trying to grow that movement more and more. Every school is looking for the opportunity to reach out to a farm or have a farm reach out to us and say, hey, you know what, I have, you know, 100 pounds of squash that we weren't able to sell at our farmer's market. Can this be used in your school programs? And yes, if we can make that connection, we are, and we will continue to do that.
So if parents were going to go to PTAs or principals and advocate for introducing or enhancing that kind of program, is it more difficult to integrate when schools are utilizing like a larger food service to run their cafeterias and things?
Or? Absolutely not. Food service management companies are also key partners that they help with getting connections with the farmers. They could buy large amounts and distribute it through the schools as well. If parents are interested, they should really be talking with legislators and say how important this is to making sure our students are connected to the farms, that our schools are connected to farms and getting the local products into our schools. They really need to reach out to the Capitol and let them know this.
And I imagine your website has a lot of information and resources, even if folks aren't in the food service or within the industry of your members.
Yes, exactly. We are on School Nutrition Association of Connecticut or the schoolnutritionassociation.org. You can also be reached at.
Very good. I appreciate your time this morning and helping educate our listeners about this important development, and hopefully they can get their energy behind making some changes, and appreciate the work you do as well with the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut, or SNACT. Kate Murphy with us here from the floor of the State Capitol at Ag Day 2025 in Connecticut. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Continuing our walk through the floor here at the Connecticut State Capitol, I have run into a voice that may be familiar to you here on the award-winning For the People. Tom Bacon is here. It represents Union B Company, but more importantly, the Farmer Veteran Coalition of Connecticut. We met him last year at the Homegrown by Heroes Farm Market in Southbury and at a couple of other locations over our mutual agricultural crossover points. So, Tom, how's things going?
Very well.
How was your season for mapling?
So I don't produce maple syrup. My friend Matt Wilkinson does.
Oh, I see.
Wilkinson,
you do
Farm.
The bees. Yes,
I do,
yes.
Bees, yes, sir.
Yeah. And so I'm told there's a neonicotinoids bill that is firing up on the floor here at the Capitol.
There are several of them, and they look pretty good. There's a few things that could be adjusted. I think a couple of the state bills say that if New York State pulls their bill back, then so do we, and I think we should just go alone on it. Keep it going.
Okay. So for folks that may be in a position to support you at this late stage of the game, could you just, as a beekeeper, let them know historically how neonicotinoids have impacted your industry?
So neonicotinoids are one of the many factors that are really stressing the bees right now. And it's really important to note that there are many factors, because this year particularly was the worst honeybee colony loss on record. So there was a 200,000 hive shortage for almond pollinations. And that's going to snowball into other industries like watermelons, onions, anything that gets pollinated. So neonicotinoids are one of the factors that add to the varroa mites and the viruses and the loss of habitat, and all of those stressors combined are really harming the honeybee health, and more importantly, the native bees that don't have any beekeepers to take care of them. So since we can't do things about everything, neonicotinoids is one of the low-hanging fruits that we have the option to do something about. So I think we should take that option.
Does this huge dip in the bee population bode well in the event that people that are listening have been thinking about maybe getting some chickens or getting a beehive? I mean, are you seeing, the single points of light making up for the bigger industrial beekeeping operations?
Yeah, so I think it's an excellent topic, and I think it's one of the most common misconceptions in beekeeping is, you know, I want to save the bees, so I'm going to get bees. Okay. So saving the bees by getting honeybees is kind of like saving the birds by getting chickens, right? The best way to save the bees is to support pollinators by building local habitat and things like that. And then supporting your local beekeepers that do it full-time for a living. Because the local beekeepers that do it full-time, they're the ones that are spearheading and trailblazing to breed stronger, more resilient bees, which is something that somebody with a smaller colony in the backyard simply won't be able to do as a hobby. It's a wonderful hobby, but it's not something to get into to save the bees.
So if you have something as big as a huge yard or meadow, or something as small as a flower box on a sixth-floor patio deck, it sounds like creating environments that will help feed and sustain pollinators, and especially bees, is probably the easiest and least expensive way of taking care of business for those like you.
Absolutely. And one of the best ways to think about it is most people, especially in Connecticut, we have a small footprint to work with, right? We can't plant 300 acres of wildflowers. So instead of planting wildflowers, you can plant trees or shrubbery and things like that. So one fully grown basswood tree can produce as much nectar as 2 acres of clover. So while we might not have the 2 acres to plant clover on, most people have the room to plant that one basswood tree in the backyard. And, you know, you can make it a focal point of the whole area to keep it.
For somebody with even a smaller footprint that's got to do like flower boxes or some bedding, is there a particular plant or flower that is ideal and resilient and easy to keep?
Mm-hmm. So there's, luckily, there's enough flowers that pretty much anything you find that's a pollinator mix will work. And the good thing about those is there's different kinds of pollinators, right? We have butterflies and we have bumblebees and things like that. And so one flower might be good for butterflies and not good for honeybees and vice versa. So the biggest thing is to plant a diverse array of flowers or trees or shrubs or whatever it's going to be.
Excellent. Well, we'll switch from our crash course in protecting and sustaining pollinators to protecting and sustaining veteran farmers, which is another passion of yours. Where did you serve?
So I was in the U.S. Army.
Thank you for your service. So we met first at the Veterans Farm Market over there in Southbury. How is the recruitment battle going for your group in terms of attracting and trying to employ and engage more veterans in farming?
So it's going very, very well. This year we started up what is now, I guess, our flagship program, and it's the Path to Victory. So that's to help new veteran farmers start up. So we offer a $500 stipend to help them pay for things like forming their LLC and things like that. We have one-on-one consulting, so if they're going to get into poultry or beef cattle or bees or whatever it is, you get free consulting with somebody that's been doing it for years to help you not just avoid roadblocks, but really kind of slingshot yourself forward. And then we also have free grant writing assistance for veteran farmers that want to apply for a grant but don't know how.
And how is the effort going in terms of... now, did this program just open up for the year? It's like an annual type of a program?
So it's ongoing. So it's been open for about 3 months. And the way people can find it, if they're a veteran and they want to get into it, is you start off with Connecticut RC&D, and they have their farm-up program. and there's a simultaneous sign up for the Path to Victory. So that's the best way for them to find it.
Excellent. How about for established veteran farmers and growers? What kind of support are they hoping to get through your organization?
So for established veteran farmers, we have the ctveterangrown.org. So it's a free website to use for both established farms and consumers. So the farm themselves, they can go on there and they can list their farm for free, what their produce is, and they can get the connection to the consumer that can go to the website and find the farm. The consumer can search by produce or beef or maple syrup or honey or whatever it is, or they can search by radius and find a veteran farm near them.
Before we wrap it up, Tom, as you're talking to some of these fledgling veteran farmers, what are some of the things that you're hearing from them that kind of, you know, gives you the faith and the power to push on?
I think it's the work ethic, right? Because, you know, most of us in the military have a very, very strong work ethic, which you're going to need if you're going to be farming, right? If you don't have it, then find a different industry.
Yeah.
But so they carry that work ethic and their desire to succeed, and that's what they need if they're going to be getting either a sideline business or a full-time job in agriculture.
Thank you so much for your time today. Tom Bacon with Union Bee Company and also with the Farmer Veteran Coalition of Connecticut. Hopefully we'll be seeing you at one of the Homegrown by Heroes, and we'll get you back on the radio, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We are continuing our traversing of the Capitol floor area here, and ran into Tracy McDougall with the Connecticut Farm Bureau. Tracy, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about what people need to know about the Bureau and what you guys do.
We are here to help advocate for agriculture at the Capitol, and also for individual farms who need assistance with challenges they may be having on their farm.
So it's a membership organization?
Yeah, we're membership-based, targeting people who are actively farming and farms of all sizes, from, you know, smaller 5-6 acres to hundreds or thousands of acres.
And when you look across the landscape of agricultural industries in Connecticut, would you say you have a pretty healthy representation of both the diversity of products as well as, you know, the quantity of farms and agricultural businesses that you'd like to see?
Yeah, our membership is very diverse, and your listeners might not know that one of the largest commodities in the state are greenhouse growers. Almost 50% of the commodities that are sales come through greenhouses in the state. That's a big industry for us. The next largest industry is dairy, which is not surprising. Those are tend to be pretty large operations. And then apples. And then from then on, you know, the commodity groups are smaller, you know, more sort of incremental.
At the same time, there seems to have been a movement over the past decade or so of either boutique farms or farms that have actually launched not only to provide food or vegetables or some sort of grown product, but also to serve as a venue to both entertain and teach people about agriculture. I'm talking about agritourism. Do you concur that is starting to become a viable revenue generator for Connecticut farms?
Yeah, agritourism is a critical source of revenue for, I would say, a majority of our farms. And as the climate change is impacting the success of a variety of different products, you throw in that agritourism source of revenue, and it provides a little stability. You know, you can count on that agritourism money coming in. So, you know, you see it in corn mazes and blueberry picking, and, you know, people do weddings and all kinds of things. So it's a really critical source of revenue for our members.
The Farm Bureau also has its finger on the pulse here at the State House in regards to legislation. And I just saw an email go across my desk a couple days ago about legislation that's being considered that might potentially help protect farms that are engaged in agritourism in regards to liability.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bill asking for recognition legally of the inherent risks involved in agritourism. So sometimes people will slip and fall in a corn maze and then sue the farm, and it's a, as your listeners know, that's a big hassle for the farmer and a big expense. And so just asking people, the law, to recognize that there are inherent risks when you're participating in agritourism activity. So we're hoping that that gets passed. We're also, there's a big push for a farm tax investment credit that we had a hearing on last week, and that would have a huge impact on our farms.
Talk more about that.
So that legislation, if you're a farmer and you buy, let's say, a tractor and it costs $160,000, you get a credit for that on your income tax. So it's a huge benefit for agriculture. And it only works if it's a capital investment, right? It's not like, oh, I bought 50 balloons for the birthday party.
Would it involve a 100% credit against the expenditure? Or is it somehow phased or scoped?
Yeah, the details of it, I'd have to look into a little bit more, but...
But it is a measurable relief.
It's 20%, so I think you take 20% of the value of that investment, and then that's credited against whatever state income tax you pay. So it's a huge... And we're excited because it encourages farmers to invest in capital in their farm. So a building, a tractor, an expensive piece of equipment. So we're excited about that proposal.
Does the Connecticut Farm Bureau also partner with other similar membership organizations to kind of, you know, put strength behind movement?
Yeah, you know, we work with Very Alive, which is a dairy organization in the eastern part of the state. We work with CT NOFA, and there's, you know, more power. The more people, the more power. So we're always looking to collaborate.
Is it? Would you mind if I just asked you, as we stand here today, because things change fast in Washington, are there any particular things that you are looking for citizen advocacy in regards to things that are happening right now in Washington that have a significant impact or could or will have a significant impact on Connecticut farmers and your members?
So there was one source of funding that our farmers really benefited from, which was money that was allocated to Connecticut Food Share to purchase food for the hungry from local Connecticut farmers, and that funding has ended, and it's a big problem. It's unfortunate for our farmers and even more unfortunate for people who are hungry. So, you know, any phone calls to your federal legislators to advocate for that would be a big help.
I have to believe our Connecticut delegation is lined up fully in support of retaining that funding. But also, you know, there's a lot of big farms in red states, too.
Yeah, agriculture cuts across all income levels and all political persuasions. And we have great relationships with Republicans and Democrats and unfortunately, all states are being affected by these ag cuts. And we have members who have implemented energy-saving projects on their farms that were funded by the federal government. And the way that this particular program works is you put in the solar panels, you've signed a contract that you'll be reimbursed for them, and now the federal government is saying there's no money there. after you've signed a contract and installed the solar panels on your farm, and you've spent $50,000 or $100,000 with a contract saying that the money will be paid, which is very similar. Like, I just had a plug-in installed in my house for my electric car, and it was the same way. I picked out an approved piece of equipment. I had it properly installed. I sent them the receipts. I had to send them a picture of the...
Your fulfillment was complete.
And then they said, great, here's your, you know, I got a stipend or whatever.
Yeah.
And so now it's the same process with our farmers, and they're being told, tough luck. So it's rough out there.
Well, hopefully folks can, you know, put their energy toward at least expressing concern and advocacy to reinstate these support programs. But before we let you go, Tracy, just let people know that the Connecticut Farm Bureaus and the regional Farm Bureaus are not exclusive membership to farmers. Anybody can be a Farm Bureau supporter.
Yeah. We need support from everyone, and we're happy to have non-farmers or even people who have a little backyard garden, and I think they would find our the information and programs that we provide would be of interest to a general audience as well.
How do they get to know you, your organization?
So we have a website, C as in cat, F as in Frank, B as in boy, A as in apple, .org. We're located in Wethersfield, Connecticut, and our phone number is 860-768-1100.
CFBA.org?
Yeah.
Tracy McDougall, president of the Connecticut Farm Bureau, here today at Ag Day at the Capitol. Thank you, Tracy. We don't like to let a year go by here at Ag Day at the Capitol without touching base with the School of Nutrition Association of Connecticut, or SNAC. Kate Murphy is with us this year. Kate, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Thank you for having me.
So give folks the quick spiel about SNAC.
So SNACT is the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut. We are the professional organization that represents anyone that works in school cafeterias in the state of Connecticut. We focus a lot on connecting classrooms to the cafeteria and educating students on where their food comes from as well.
So you guys are responsible for making sure that kids know food doesn't grow on big box shelves.
Correct. A funny story is I talked with a student a couple years ago, and I asked them if they knew where pickles came from, and they said the grocery store. So I knew that was my opportunity to teach children how to actually make their own pickles out of cucumbers.
And I have to believe, thanks to your movement and those partnering with you, that we now have at least a couple of generations of young Connecticut residents, for the most part, who are much more aware of where food comes from.
Yes, and it's so important right now that we have funding to help connect our farmers to our cafeterias. We are starting the movement that we are purchasing directly from the farmers and using those products in our school cafeterias to feed our young students.
We could spend an entire segment just talking about the issues on the education side of what's coming out of Washington, but for your purposes, there is a need for public outcry against the severing of funding that will be, it would have been in place or would be in place to help connect Connecticut farmers and the products they grow to the most important customers, Connecticut's young people, through the school networks.
Absolutely. It's an important piece to get the actual local products to our students so they understand we're helping our local people. We're helping our farmer that lives next door to us. We're also, the Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids Grant is also another key piece to funding that our state needs. And it's helping students grow their own food in their classrooms and teaching them that it doesn't come from the grocery store, that they can grow it themselves.
This is also an important movement addressing food insecurity, as you are, so to speak, teaching the person to create their own food because they may not have the money to go to the store and buy it. These days, that's a growing critical concern.
Yes, absolutely. If we could just teach one child how to grow their own lettuce or how to grow squash and then teach them what they can do with that, how to nourish their bodies with the things that they're actually growing themselves.
Tell us about some of the programs that you're involved with that will be sustained through this year and into the future.
Well, right now we have funding to purchase local right now, but that is ending at the end of this school year. A lot of schools are losing that funding at the end of the school year to help purchase local products.
And when we're talking about Connecticut Grown for Connecticut Kids, do you have some idea of the scope of farm involvement with the program? In other words, how much of Connecticut's farming output up to now is pipelining into our Connecticut school system?
That I actually don't have the statistics on, but we are trying to grow that movement more and more. Every school is looking for the opportunity to reach out to a farm or have a farm reach out to us and say, hey, you know what, I have, you know, 100 pounds of squash that we weren't able to sell at our farmer's market. Can this be used in your school programs? And yes, if we can make that connection, we are, and we will continue to do that.
So if parents were going to go to PTAs or principals and advocate for introducing or enhancing that kind of program, is it more difficult to integrate when schools are utilizing, like, a larger food service to run their cafeterias and things? Or?
Absolutely not. Food service management companies are also key partners that they help with getting connections with the farmers. They can buy large amounts and distribute it through the schools as well. If parents are interested, they should really be talking with legislators and say how important this is to making sure our students are connected to the farms, that our schools are connected to farms and getting the local products into our schools. They really need to reach out to the Capitol and let them know this.
And I imagine your website has a lot of information and resources, even if folks aren't in the food service or within the industry of your members.
Yes, exactly. We are on School Nutrition Association of Connecticut or the schoolnutritionassociation.org. You can also be reached at.
Very good. I appreciate your time this morning and helping educate our listeners about this important development, and hopefully they can get their energy behind making some changes, and appreciate the work you do as well with the School Nutrition Association of Connecticut, or SNACT. Kate Murphy with us here from the floor of the State Capitol at Ag Day 2025 in Connecticut. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you.
Continuing our walk through the floor here at the Connecticut State Capitol, I have run into a voice that may be familiar to you here on the award-winning For the People. Tom Bacon is here. It represents Union B Company, but more importantly, the Farmer Veteran Coalition of Connecticut. We met him last year at the Homegrown by Heroes Farm Market in Southbury and at a couple of other locations over our mutual agricultural crossover points. So, Tom, how's things going?
Very well.
How was your season for mapling?
So I don't produce maple syrup. My friend Matt Wilkinson does.
Oh, I see.
Wilkinson,
you do
Farms.
The bees.
I do bees.
Yes
sir.
Yeah. And so I'm told there's a neonicotinoids bill that is firing up on the floor here at the Capitol.
There are several of them, and they look pretty good. There's a few things that could be adjusted. I think a couple of the state bills say that if New York State pulls their bill back, then so do we, and I think we should just go alone on it. Keep it going.
Okay. So for folks that may be in a position to support you at this late stage of the game, could you just, as a beekeeper, let them know historically how neonicotinoids have impacted your industry?
So neonicotinoids are one of the many factors that are really stressing the bees right now. And it's really important to note that there are many factors, because this year particularly was the worst honeybee colony loss on record. So there was a 200,000 hive shortage for almond pollinations. And that's going to snowball into other industries like watermelons, onions, anything that gets pollinated. So neonicotinoids are one of the factors that add to the varroa mites and the viruses and the loss of habitat. And all of those stressors combined are really harming the honeybee health and, more importantly, the native bees that don't have any beekeepers to take care of them. So since we can't do things about everything, neonicotinoids is one of the low-hanging fruits that we have the option to do something about. So I think we should take that option.
Does this huge dip in the bee population bode well in the event that people that are listening have been thinking about maybe getting some chickens or getting a beehive? I mean, are you seeing, the single points of light making up for the bigger industrial beekeeping operations?
Yeah, so I think it's an excellent topic, and I think it's one of the most common misconceptions in beekeeping is, I want to save the bees, so I'm going to get bees. Okay. So saving the bees by getting honeybees is kind of like saving the birds by getting chickens, right? The best way to save the bees is to support pollinators by building local habitat and things like that. And then supporting your local beekeepers that do it full-time for a living. Because the local beekeepers that do it full-time, they're the ones that are spearheading and trailblazing to breed stronger, more resilient bees, which is something that somebody with a smaller colony in the backyard simply won't be able to do as a hobby. It's a wonderful hobby, but it's not something to get into to save the bees.
So if you have something as big as a huge yard or meadow, or something as small as a flower box on a sixth-floor patio deck, it sounds like creating environments that will help feed and sustain pollinators, and especially bees, is probably the easiest and least expensive way of taking care of business for those like you.
Absolutely. And one of the best ways to think about it is most people, especially in Connecticut, we have a small footprint to work with, right? We can't plant 300 acres of wildflowers. So instead of planting wildflowers, you can plant trees or shrubbery and things like that. So one fully grown basswood tree can produce as much nectar as 2 acres of clover. So while we might not have the 2 acres to plant clover on, most people have the room to plant that one basswood tree in the backyard. And, you can make it a focal point of the whole area to keep it.
For somebody with even a smaller footprint that's got to do like flower boxes or some bedding, is there a particular plant or flower that is ideal and resilient and easy to keep?
Mm-hmm. So there's, luckily, there's enough flowers that pretty much anything you find that's a pollinator mix will work. And the good thing about those is there's different kinds of pollinators, right? We have butterflies and we have bumblebees and things like that. And so one flower might be good for butterflies and not good for honeybees and vice versa. So the biggest thing is to plant a diverse array of flowers or trees or shrubs or whatever it's going to be.
Excellent. Well, we'll switch from our crash course in protecting and sustaining pollinators to protecting and sustaining veteran farmers, which is another passion of yours. Where did you serve?
So I was in the U.S. Army.
Thank you for your service. So we met first at the Veterans Farm Market over there in Southbury. How is the recruitment battle going for your group in terms of attracting and trying to employ and engage more veterans in farming?
So it's going very, very well. This year we started up what is now, I guess, our flagship program, and it's the Path to Victory. So that's to help new veteran farmers start up. So we offer a $500 stipend to help them pay for things like forming their LLC and things like that. We have one-on-one consulting, so if they're going to get into poultry or beef cattle or bees or whatever it is, you get free consulting with somebody that's been doing it for years to help you not just avoid roadblocks, but really kind of slingshot yourself forward. And then we also have free grant writing assistance for veteran farmers that want to apply for a grant but don't know how.
And how is the effort going in terms of... Now, did this program just open up for the year? It's like an annual type of a program?
So it's ongoing. So it's been open for about 3 months, and the way people can find it, if they're a veteran and they want to get into it, is you start off with Connecticut RC&D, and they have their farm-up program, and there's a simultaneous sign-up for the Path to Victory. So that's the best way for them to find it.
Excellent. How about for established veteran farmers and growers, what kind of support are they hoping to get through your organization?
So for established veteran farmers, we have the ctveterangrown.org. So it's a free website to use for both established farms and consumers. So the farm themselves, they can go on there and they can list their farm for free, what their produce is, and they can get the connection to the consumer that can go to the website and find the farm. The consumer can search by produce or beef or maple syrup or honey or whatever it is, or they can search by radius and find a veteran farm near them.
Before we wrap it up, Tom, as you're talking to some of these fledgling veteran farmers, what are some of the things that you're hearing from them that kind of, you know, gives you the faith and the power to push on?
I think it's the work ethic, right? Because, you know, most of us in the military have a very, very strong work ethic, which you're going to need if you're going to be farming, right? If you don't have it, then find a different industry.
Yeah.
But so they carry that work ethic and their desire to succeed, and that's what they need if they're going to be getting a either a sideline business or a full-time job in agriculture.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time today. Tom Bacon with Union Bee Company and also with the Farmer Veteran Coalition of Connecticut. Hopefully we'll be seeing you at one of the Homegrown by Heroes, and we'll get you back on the radio, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation. But the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.